I'm the doctor. These are my new best friends, Ryan, Graham and Yaz.
Hello and welcome to episode 86 of Doctor Who Target Files, discussing the penultimate episode of Doctor Who Season 11, It Takes You Away. Written by Ed Heim and directed by Jamie Childs, this is Mike in Swansea.
And hello, it's Alex in Exeter. It's sort of very stripped down and sort of very cold, it felt. I did enjoy it, but I know it's not getting much love out there, but what I thought it was a very clever episode and didn't really need a great deal to get into it. What do you think of it, Mike?
Just a very atmospheric mixture of fairy tale, a bit of horror in there, a bit of things that Doctor Who has done very well in the past, and I think it did it very well this time.
Clever idea of this sort of, you know, it's a cottage in the middle of Norway and nobody knows why people are there, and you get this beautifully acted blind actress and blind girl who's completely controlled by the love of her father and then sort of thinks there's a monster. We find out later it's just noise what's created by it. And I thought it's beautifully shot. It looks gorgeous, this whole episode does. And even with the sort of Neverworld, sort of, you know, what they go into through the portal and that, sort of, every bit looks stunning. I just don't understand why people haven't loved this episode, because I think it's brilliant.
Jamie Childs returning for his fourth episode, final episode of Season 11, the penultimate story. A very lush-looking opening, overlooking a ford in Norway, as we find out, 2018. Nice bit of humour from Jodie's Doctor about the woolly invasion, which we're apparently going to see in about 190 years' time on Earth. Probably won't be around for that one, Al, will we?
I don't think so. I loved all that bit about the sheep, where, you know, he thinks the sheep are a threat and sort of sonics them and find out are just normal sheep. Throughout this episode, there are some beautiful bits of humour sort of mixed in with sort of very sort of sad bits, you know, later on, I thought.
And then they discover a mysterious house in the woods, a cabin. There's that shot you can take one way or the other in certain films, isn't it? I find it quite creepy, certainly in this sort of story, compared to something at the beginning of the 11th Hour, which had more of a fantastical tale about the way it was shot. But what I mean, Al, is the idea of an empty swing.
Oh yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, that sort of swing, what sort of swinging you think you could be, how you swing it. Yeah, I think it can be taken as quite creepy. A little bit, you know, so you don't know if there's another hand behind it or somebody's there. And I thought that, you don't know what's going on with this house, you know, you've walk into it and think who's there, basically. It's all boarded up and it's all very, you know, secluded, really. And I really looked really, I thought it was very creepy, to be honest.
And Yaz's and Graham and Ryan's inquisitiveness. You know, one of the TARDIS team says there's a child here because of all the shoes. And then Graham immediately says, oh, or a maniac who collects kids' shoes.
There's these lovely bits between those three companions, you know, because they've really got to a good point now. And seeing all the sweet wrappers and the shoes and everything, sort of where this whole shot is just really beautiful, I thought. You know, the sort of very isolation of the house comes over well in these sort of first shot.
Yes, and then, as you alluded to, we meet a blind young lady, Hannah, played by Ellie Warwick, I think, one of her first roles. How do you feel she took this role on, Al? Of course, a person with limited eyesight as a human being, as a real person as well. Al, how do you feel she stepped into the Hooniverse?
I think she does it really well. And I think, you know, that whole, the way, you know, the Doctor gets around that sort of blindness thing very quickly by asking her directly. And most people don't do that. And I think that's really sort of, those sort of shots with Jodie and her were really good when, you know, she asks you blind. And then the sort of way that Ryan sort of deals with it badly, and the sort of, she immediately goes into thinking that he's pitying her because of her sight, because he's not, he's just being not very good with young people, unfortunately, Ryan as well. I thought her acting was really good all the way through this episode, because she's actually a blind actress, and I thought the sort of the way she came over was brilliant, I thought.
Yes, I'm going to think of a comparison, Al. Last year, we saw Peter Capaldi's Doctor become temporarily blind. Is there a difference in terms of the performer being somebody who suffered from, or somebody who has this type of condition, and somebody who doesn't?
I think there's a little bit, because you're not, you know, when you're performing, though Peter Capaldi was really good but you know, actually acting as blind, yeah, you know, that was pretty close to being blind. I thought the way he acted it, but I think because you know it's actually her state of being, including her acting, you know, from you know because he's been blind since birth, I think, because he has been, and seeing that you know, it's sort of living that world, and it's sort of, I thought the acting was it, but very. You know, it's more close to how blindness really is with her. But even that, I still think, because you know, Peter Capaldi had really good people teaching him and showing him how it is. I think that Doctor Who's always been, in the last 2 years, one thing, what you know, sort of Doctor Who has really come in the forefront about, you know, having really good either blind actresses or showing that being blind isn't hindrance, it's just part of how things can be sometimes. And I think Doctor Who's only the sort of one sort of drama does put you know disabilities forward very well, I think, and it has a lot of disability fans, as we've known, and I think it's a good way of getting it forward. And it was a good, and I thought her acting was brilliant. I thought in the way she sort of wanted her dad, and it's just, you know, if you were stuck in the middle of nowhere, you'd want that sort of thing, really. I thought she was really good last night, I mean on Sunday when we saw it.
Yes, I mean, I often talk about sort of acting in the eyes, something William Hartnell gave his advice to William Russell, Ian Chesterton, back in the 1960s, the early days of the show. You know, Ellie was able to convey so much, you know, just facial expressions, just tone of voice. It was, as you said, a wonderful performance.
Yeah, I think there was some lovely little bits of her eyes and lovely bits how she, you know, that bit when the Doctor tries, you know, to trick her by saying, oh, we're writing a map, and she instantly knows and confronts Ryan about it later, but it's her writing on the wall. And there's just little details, the way, you know, she acts and the way, you know, later when she gets put into the second universe and she tries following the Doctor's sort of string ideas, what don't go well, and it's sort of, she's just really got, you know, the right length of feeling over, I thought.
Possibly an unfair comparison with Capaldi last year, as it was the nature of the character that his sight issue had come on all of a sudden, and Ellie just conveyed her character as being someone confident from the start, you know, somebody who is used to having this condition. That's the way they experience the world.
Yeah, definitely. That sort of bit with Capaldi's blindness, so it was very good. It was like, this is just going to happen for a bit, and then I still get the sight back eventually, because that's the way that, you know, you couldn't have the Doctor blind permanently because of the way, you know, the Doctor is. But with her, it was like, you know, this is how I am, and this is how my life is, basically, and I'm going to get on with it, and that's the way it should be, really.
And we meet her father, don't we? We don't meet him straight away, but we understand her father's gone out, called Eric. And there's quite rightfully so a lot of concern from Yaz and Graham. And we move on to Portal Within a Mirror, Al, a very age-old fairy tale usage of that.
Oh, definitely, you know, because they sort of, Ryan and Graham sort of end up nearly being put through the mirror, because that great little bit of humour there where they can't see their reflections and they think they're both vampires for a second, that sort of great bit where Ryan sort of comes up on Graham and he gives him a heart attack by jumping on. I think the mirror bit's a really good idea. I mean, I just don't get why people didn't get this episode last night. It had so many really good things going on in it, but I think it, the mirror thing works really well, and it's sort of the whole portal thing going into sort of never space sort of area, and I think it was a really good idea.
Yeah, almost very Neil Gaiman, Terry Pratchett-esque, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that was definitely on the mind of you know, writing this, you know, looking at how, you know, how you end up in another world on top of a world, basically, the whole sort of this world outlook. I did think of that when I was watching it, and it's like, then you got into that world, in the Doctor and like, her friends, and then you meet this very sort of weird character who wants to eat everybody, basically.
Ribbons of the Nine Stomachs, I think it was, played by Kevin Eldon.
And I thought it was Kevin Eldon, because he's really creepy and horrible, it was very good, I thought. Immediately wants to eat the Doctor's juicy brain. You know, it's very, like, I have to admit, my mum, I was watching it at home at my mum's house for my birthday, and I had it on, and my mum was basically having her eyes closed on most of those bits.
Yes, it was quite a large element of horror at times, and always been a big fan of Kevin Eldon for the last two decades, ever since Big Train, the show he was in back with a great ensemble, including Simon Pegg, 1999, I think the first season was on.
Yeah, it's one of those sort of comedies at the time that people did miss, and it's one of those really good comedies, Big Trends. But Kevin Eldon's fantastic when he does. He's winning loads of things. He's playing this very disgustingly creepy sort of, I don't know how to describe him, he's a very, very nasty person who basically wants to eat everything around him. And then you get to meet these other really nasty characters, these very big sort of giant moths, who basically were freaking my mum out when she was watching it. I think after watching it back here, I can see why she had her eyes closed for nearly half of the episode.
One of those characters that could so easily become played as a caricature in Doctor Who, but he gives it sort of several sinister layers.
Yeah, he's really sort of layered and creepy and sort of, you know, I will, you know, want you, and if you want any information off me, you need to give me more credit, and you need to give me the sonic screwdriver, he's sort of bartering with, really. I thought it's very creepy, very nasty, and that bit where he throws the rats to the moth creeps and they eat them alive is very nasty.
And very deceptive as well, you know, the whole idea of Jodie saying, of course he had two knives.
Yeah, there's lovely bits there between them. He's like, you know, of course he's going to kill us all, you know. He's, you know, and then you meet these disgusting moth creatures that basically will eat anything in sight, and they end up eating him very nastily.
Yeah, I had to double check two or three times on the second watch to see if he had died, because I wasn't sure if he had another sort of helper with him who was devoured by the moths, but it was Ribbons himself.
Well, yeah, but he doesn't really, thanks to the audio description, he doesn't say that he gets eaten alive, but yeah, when you're watching it, you can't really see if he is eaten alive till you meet his sort of skeleton later, really.
And then we end up with the Doctor, I think, and Graham and Yaz. Just those three, isn't it, in the Mirror universe, yeah, where we meet,
yeah,
Eric.
In the other sort of universe, this is how complicated this episode gets, with another universe inside the Mirror universe, if that makes sense, yeah. Where they meet, is it Eric and his wife was dead, he's not dead, and then they meet Graham's wife again. The name has just gone out of my head, he's played beautifully.
Grace.
Grace, that's it, Grace. Grace is just, and she's played beautifully there, and it's sort of, you know, it's, there's some really brilliant bits with Bradley Walsh when we get to the sort of the Mirror world, because he just doesn't want to believe that she's there, and she sort of starts to convince him, I think.
And it's a very subtle performance, isn't it, by Sharon D. Clarke, because you get part of the essence of Grace, but it's not quite fully her. She manages to do something with her face, possibly keeps it a little bit stiller than she normally would in terms of expressions, and she manages to convey elements of Grace, but you always get the feeling it's not quite her.
No, you get that feeling because, you know, from the minute you sort of see her, you don't see her in focus to begin with, and it's sort of, you think it's not quite her, and it's obvious to the viewers, what to Graham, it's, he thinks it's her, really.
Yes, and then we return briefly to Ryan and Hannah back in the normal Our World, of course, and it tos and fros, and we end up towards the episode's ending when people are battling whether to go between the two worlds.
Yeah, and this is the whole thing. Do you think the whole between the worlds and the reason the Doctor comes out actually makes sense? I thought it did once the Doctor explained what was the point of the other worlds. Well, I think it can get a bit complicated, this episode.
Was it one world trying to burst through into ours? And
I think that's what's going on with it, because even I was having problems. It's quite a complicated storyline, I think.
And what is the Netherworld is the barrier in between?
Yeah, the Netherworld is the bit with all the nasty moths and all that, is the sort of barrier bit, and around it are the two worlds, in Our World and the Mirror World. I think that's how you work it. Even I'm getting confused.
So the Netherworld is almost like a lock, so you could compare it to the species being kept in the trees last week in the Witchfinders, I suppose.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, yeah, I think you could say it like that. And it's just unfortunately, well, it's squeezed into the episode. I think it does need, again, I think this is another one that needs more space. But yeah, I think Sharon D. Clarke's character is beautifully played in this. Really gets Graham's hopes up for like the first bit, till she makes one little mistake of saying, you know, not telling him not to go back for Ryan, and that instantly makes Graham think this is not her, basically.
Yes, various levels of jeopardy put in there before we have the decision made to send everybody back. Hannah's father, Eric, as well.
Yeah, there's lots of lovely little bits of the Doctor trying to persuade Graham what, you know, this is not Grace, this is actually something else. And, you know, and the whole, you know, she tries to convince him with the frog necklaces and that, and it doesn't, that would have worked until the last bit where he goes, no, you don't need to help Ryan, and that instantly makes him think. And then the whole bits between Eric and his wife are good as well. I think the actor playing Eric is actually not too bad in this.
No, a very good supporting cast all round this week, I feel. And then towards the grand denouement, we had a lovely moment put on the end there, where we finally get Ryan calling Graham something.
Yeah, there's that lovely bit where Graham's had this whole sort of emotional baggage put on him again by Grace, and then he gets back and everything's right, and, you know, Ryan finally calls him Granddad, and that really helps him, you know, get, and makes him smile, and it's great. And I think that's a lovely little touch, you know, after we've had, I suppose we better mention the frogs as well here, you know, the whole fact, well, the entity turns into a frog by the end. It's just a bit weird. If you don't like frogs, you're not going to like this episode. I have to say, if you don't like insects, you're not going to like this episode, because there is a lot of insects in this episode. Big frogs, moths. I think it does have a high end of body horror in this episode, I think.
I wasn't doing it on purpose, just so we could forget about it. Just so we could skip or hop past the frog, should I say?
I
honestly wasn't on purpose. I'd honestly forgotten, but I loved it. I'm on the side that loved it.
I'm on the side that loved it as well. I thought it's a really clever episode, but I can also see why people are moaning about, it's too, what on earth's going on? But I thought it was really well paced. It had a nice... you started on one foot, and then by the end, you were completely on another foot of why this all happened. And I think the way that the Doctor explained it all worked well, and you get to know a bit more about the whole Grant and what the Doctor had. I thought this episode was really good. It had a nice sort of middle end and beginning to it, so I really liked it as well.
Scene with the frog allowed Jodie to have two pretty heavy scenes emotionally next to each other, and I think that's helped the Doctor grow further.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Those two scenes to connect together show an awful lot of the whole new Doctor's personality. And I think it works. It works so well when you get, Jodie doing good bits of dialogue. I think she knows how to pitch it well. And unlike, some people out there who really hate her Doctor, I think her Doctor's brilliant in this.
I've started to wonder, though. I was wondering when we'd get perhaps a big speech from Jodie's Doctor. But I think we've possibly gone backwards, more towards the Eccleston era, because Tennant, Smith and Capaldi were the ones done with a little bit of bombast. Sorry to use that phrase again, but they really went for it, in terms of the big, bold music, marigold music behind them. But I think Jodie was a little bit more like an Eccleston. We have those smaller reserve moments, like the moment in Rose where he explains to her about the turn of the earth. That's sort of almost understated, big in scope, but an understated set of words.
Yeah, I would think what Jodie's Doctor is more... in temperament, like the Christopher Eccleston Doctor, if she gets annoyed, she will explode, and she's very kind and generous to the people. I don't think she goes in for the big, sort of furious rage bits like Matt Smith and David Tennant and Capaldi. They went in for the big, I am angry sort of speech. So I think her bits will be, they are there, like we saw this week, there was bits of real... I'm not liking you. I want to show you what this world is mammoth still. And I think she goes in for very, Eccleston did, sort of understated bits, which you will miss and want to go back and watch again. I think this episode is a definite rewatch, I think, and more than once. And I don't know if I had someone on Facebook going, well, why do you need to watch something the second time if it's not good in the first time? I personally think sometimes with Who, you need to watch it again to get the full bit of it, really.
Yes, you can get caught up in the first watch of anything.
Yeah, I normally do. I normally, these days we all have a phone at hand, we're all doing other things. And I think you miss something in the first watch and a second watch. And that's, I think a drama is a good drama if you have to go back and watch it again and think, I missed something. I think that's how I look at it, really.
Yes, because I know people talk about, the video age from the 80s when we started to rewatch things. Unfortunately, the throwaway culture of the BBC that led to there being missing episodes. But even in those days, people sort of read books again, didn't they? People listened to various albums again, as we still also do to these days.
Like myself, I know people who read The Lord of the Rings every year. And they read, you get a favourite book from a child, you like to read it every again. I've got loads like that. And it's like, I don't get the feelings where people go, if you didn't like it on the first watch, why are you reviewing it and saying it's good on the second watch then? But I think a lot of this season has taken a second watch, really. And I think, was this a better episode because it's nothing really to do with Chignall? That's what I wonder sometimes.
Well, we shall see. Two left now, Al. Well, just had the schedule for New Year's Day today, and it's going to be 7 o'clock, the Christmas special, and this weekend, 6:30, the finale. So
that will be good. That will be good. And is that why there's no date for the Blu-ray yet? Do you reckon they're going to include the New Year's Day episode in the Blu-ray box set? Because there's no exact date for ordering it, I don't think.
I would think so. Otherwise, you think they probably would have slipped it in before Christmas to maximise sales.
Well, that's what
sales.
I thought it was going to be out before Christmas. I did put it on my list, my Christmas list. Well, I think what I can see on Amazon, there's no actual date. Well, I do think they did say you can pre-order it at the end of this week's episode. So maybe there is a date and I haven't looked.
Okay, Al, shall we score It Takes You Away?
Yeah, I think we will. It's a really clever episode. It keeps you going for the whole episode. You get a good pace of sort of horror and fright from the beginning, and I thought there was some really good acting from the, you know, main cast and also the background cast. You know, I thought Kevin Alden as this really nasty monster was quite scary and frightening. And if you didn't like insects, you will have hated this. But I thought it was really nice and it was very scary. I thought it had a really good sort of scary background to it. So I think I really liked it. I did enjoy it. And I've watched it twice now. I think it's a really good episode. So I think I'm going to go, I'm trying to think if I actually didn't like anything about it. I got a bit confused with the different worlds, but I understand what's going on there. So I think I will give it a 9, I think.
Yes, same as me, I'm going to give it a 9. Very atmospheric, very well paced, superb performance by Ellie, the partially sighted actress. Superb performance, lovely to see Grace back again, some very great doctory moments. Sagan's score, suitable for this type of episode. Perhaps not the flourish we've seen in some of his most recent weeks' scores, but a solid 9 for me. And I did like Kermit's cousin Robin the Frog, so there we go.
I know, it's a bit of an interesting one. See, none of that was actually a model or CGI of the frog, but I don't know what it was. It just didn't look quite right, did it?
Talking of second watches, it took me second watch to realise again that it was actually the frog actually had Grace's voice.
Well, yeah, it does have Grace's voice from the start of Finn the Frog, doesn't it?
Yes, no, but I just sort of was taken in. It seemed a bit surreal watching that scene, first of all, from what had come before, so I didn't really take it in that it was her voice until the second watch.
Ah, yeah, that's the sort of good thing about the second watch. See, you notice things more. I think that was very clever of the frog having Grace's voice. I think this whole thing where, because, you know, if you watch it on the episode one, you just think he's in one episode. I think he's now been in through flashbacks and other reasons. He's been in about 3 episodes now. I wonder if she's going to be in the final episode, Sharon D. Clarke as Grace.
The Battle of Ranskorav Kulur.
I know, it's got a really weird, I saw that as well, it's got a really weird long title, hasn't it, the final episode. And I'm just wondering, does it work this year? Because, you know, normally with the, you know, episodes, what would be 11 and 12, which is the final episode, we're down to 10 this year. But normally they're like connected together, or there's been some big arc. Have you liked it not being a big arc, being different things each week?
Yes, possibly as a one-off. Perhaps it's something I'd like to see return along with the returning villains, which I think we'll probably get one or two of next year. But it's been interesting because there's been a theory going around ever since the show returned that we have to see the Daleks every year, and we haven't as of yet, and there's no real sign. They could have kept them a secret that they'll be appearing until next year at least.
I don't think they're going to be there till next year. I don't think they're going to be there next year. I think he's going to continue how he is, basically. I think Chris Kidnell will do. I reckon he's going to wait till if he gets to a third year, because there's all these stupid rumours going around about him and Jodie are leaving after next year, which I don't think is true, personally. That one's been sort of going around the internet for about a month now, where they've had enough and they're all going to leave. I don't think that's true, personally. I don't know, because I think if you have Daleks, you have Cybermen all the time, then they just lose their sort of menace, I think. And that was the problem, I think, by the end of the Moffat bit. I know what Big Finish like using them, because they sell more than, you know, other episodes. If you put a Dalek on a cover, it sells more, as we all know. But yeah, I think the sort of not having the main sort of villains has worked. I've liked quite a few of the ideas that Chris Chibnall's come up. I know lots of people out there don't like the fact that, you know, he has used more politics in his villains than normally in Doctor Who, and I think it's worked, really.
Yes, I mean, looking at someone like the Daleks, I think people overestimate their impact. Season 10, we had one appear in the pilot episode. We had one briefly appear in Twice Upon a Time, but it's actually 3 years since Series 9, autumn 2015, since we had a Dalek-centred story.
Ah, so that sort of gap might work in its behalf then. You know, we've always had little cameos from Daleks and quite a few things now, but I think an actual good centred Dalek story would be a good thing if it's done well.
Yes, as you alluded to, the rumours of Jodie and Chris possibly leaving after Series 12, it just seems to me to be the latest thing that the people who want this show to fail because of the direction it's taken now, that's the latest argument they're throwing. We've seen the ratings for It Takes You Away, 5.07 million, slightly down on the overnights for the series so far, but people are taking that as a total fact that the ratings just are going down and down. But of course we have to wait for catch up nowadays. It's still getting strongly reviewed critically wise. We're still going to get a series next year.
Yeah, I think you shouldn't you know, they shouldn't worry about the ratings, because even if it was 5, it was still, when you add caps, it would probably be in the 7s, which on a Sunday night, to be honest, in Britain, British TV, anything getting more than 4 is extremely good. You know, Sunday nights are a hard ball to crack ratings-wise, because, you know, it's the end of the weekend and people just want to sit down, but they don't really care what they want, they just want to relax, really. So I think anything that gets 7 to 8 million viewers, is, you know, is a, they deserve the second series, basically, or the 12th series, basically.
Yes, and we have big hitters as well getting towards their finals the end of the year, don't we? Like Strictly had its final, The X Factor had its final on a Sunday. I'm a Celebrity is in full swing now.
I think Sundays work, but it's a hard thing if you want to stick a drama on a Sunday to get. The whole Saturday thing moving to Sunday worked because, you know, the ratings have gone up. You know, it's a simple fact. You know, the last season of Peter Capaldi got, you know, because they stuck it up against Britain's Got Talent, it was getting like 4 on every episode. And that's with catch-up. It was getting like 4 or 5 with catch-up, where the Jodie season this season has got like 7 to 8 million each week with catch-up. So that sort of says that this idea of moving from Saturday to Sunday has definitely worked. And I think it should stay on the Sunday, definitely.
Speaking of catch-up, iPlayer, it's been announced, has achieved its best ever results in October. And Doctor Who is a big part of those. Top 10 episodes for October, Killing Eve number 1. Doctor Who, The Woman Who Fell to Earth was number 2.
All very good stuff. No, I'm not surprised with Killing Eve was top, because that was pretty good, except for the last episode. And Doctor Who, that's what exactly we want. I think a lot of people did watch, you know, The Woman Fell to Earth because it was a new Doctor and that, but I think it hasn't gone down in good writing. He said, I don't know, because I think the episodes I have liked, I have to put my hands up and say, the ones I've liked from this season haven't been Chris Chibnall doing everything.
Other news, we have tickets announced for the new escape game Doctor Who Worlds Collide, which is going to be in 6 locations across the UK. Bristol, Leeds, Oxford, Manchester, Reading, Birmingham. Between January and March this year. None in Wales where the show is made, but Bristol's close enough for us.
Bristol's close enough, unfortunately. I expect that, you know, you're going to get the new experience, whatever they call it, in next year, I reckon, in Cardiff Castle.
They will be on sale from Thursday the 6th of December, this coming Thursday at midday.
I have to admit, so I've never actually tried, I know what they are, escape room things, but I've actually never ever tried an escape room thing. Have you?
No, not yet. No great desire if I was invited along, I probably wouldn't take a group of people myself. If I was invited along with others, I'd probably do it.
Yeah, I think they sound good fun. I know there was a very popular, I know there was a great Talk to It episode in the new season 6, being big Finish Box set about the whole very violently nasty escape room thing. So I think they sound good fun. I think that one's going to be good because it's going to have lots of Doctor Who bits in it.
And I'm just looking at a Digital Spy article which says Doctor Who stars respond to bizarre claims that the show is too PC.
Ridiculous thing where correctness in all angles of this season. I completely disagree there.
Well, it's come from this side of the pond too. Well, you know what's happened politically in the last few years, so people are creating arguments which I think can be quite easily batted down, but when you consider the history behind how certain groups of people have been treated...
Most definitely. And I think, yeah, if you want, you can't really win with Doctor Who, because people want historical episodes of Doctor Who. You're going to have to deal with the correlation between how our world is now and how it was back then. And there is a high chance you're going to get a bit of political correctness in that. And then they moan about how, BBC has completely gone politically correct, you know, we can't say what we want any longer. And it's sort of, no, this is just meant to be a bit of 45 minutes fun. Deal with it, for God's sake.
And they've mentioned Julie Hesman-Halg, guest starred in Kablam, of course, famous for Coronation Street in this country, who labelled the claims a load of bollocks. So, and we have Mandip Gill, Yaz, of course, saying it makes me laugh because having the words too and correct in the same sentence is really bizarre to me. How can you be too correct about something?
I know, I saw that article you said as well. It's like, are you going to check every word you say and then is that making you too correct? God, that's a nightmare.
And then Tosin Cole, Ryan says, everyone's going to have their own opinion. It is what it is. The fact that we can give everyone a little friendly, entertaining reminder of these issues is great.
Well, that is true. You know, people are actually talking about it because of Doctor Who, and that's always a good thing, because conversation and debates, the only way you're going to get around these things, unfortunately. There are some really awful YouTube podcast videos out there from Americans who absolutely loathe this season because of it being too politically correct. Still, the whole woman angle as well, and the sort of, you know, really don't like the fact that there's been too many historical episodes.
Been catching up with Big Finish this week. Any news of new releases for them?
I know it's out, I think it's out this week or next week, is the War Master box set, the second one with great Derek Jacobi as the War Master, they're calling him now, and that looks very good. The Paul Spragg Memorial short story's been announced. I think that's the other thing with Big Finish. Because we've got to the end of the year, we've got some beautiful things in January. There's 10 people in January, they've got their Missy box set and the Riverson Season 5 with 5 different masters. I think that is definitely on my shopping list for January, I think.
Yes, just looking at the news stories page. Short Trips Opportunity 2018.
That's the Paul Spragg thing I was on about.
Yeah, the Paul Spragg Memorial Award release. That is Short Trips Opportunity 2018.
Named after the late Paul Spragg, who was I don't know if you emailed, I met him at Big Finish Day once. He was absolutely a gentleman. And always very helpful if you emailed Big Finish, and you know, since he unfortunately died very young, they set up the sort of every year where you can write your own particular Doctor Who story, and hopefully if you win, it gets made as a short trip read by Nick Briggs. I think it's been read by,
yes, wonderful, they can do that in his memory.
Most definitely, because he was sort of just one of these people. I met him a couple of times, and he was always very helpful and very friendly. So it's a shame, because he died very young. It sort of did affect Big Finish a lot, I think, because lots of people really like working with him there. So they've done this in his memory, basically. What about your media? Because I know you've seen it before I have. I'm going to go and see it on Thursday. What did you think of your Creed 2 experience?
Really enjoyed the film, Al. Started last Friday night, managed to catch up with the previous 6 Rocky films and the first Creed movie before watching Creed 2 earlier today. Just a wonderfully pacey film. I had spoken to you earlier about I don't like sitting in a cinema for more than 2 hours at the moment, and this film is around about 2 hours 17 minutes, but it just flies by pace-wise. So much pathos. Really hit me at the moment because I don't know if the listeners know this, but my father passed away 2 weeks ago, but I have strong memories of a nine-year-old going with my dad, brother, and a few other friends to the old Odeon in Swansea to watch Rocky IV. That would have been probably January, springtime, wintertime, 1986 when it came out.
Yeah, about then. That's when it came out. That is one of the really good Rocky films. Yeah, I just wonder because, you know, I haven't actually seen Creed, the first Creed film yet, but I went to see the last Rocky film when it came out. And I thought it was good. I thought it was back on form. You always worry with these sort of big franchises, like, you know, it's Sylvester Stallone trying to do what he's done before. I think the Creed's made very good, and I've heard very good things about Creed too. And I will hopefully go and see it on Thursday and try out my new lovely headphones my mum brought me for my birthday before the old description. Then that should be fine.
Yes, happy birthday for Sunday just gone, Alex.
Thank you. It was a very good birthday.
Yes, my brother's 45 today. He's 5 years away from 50. That's scary.
What else is? So I'm tempted to go and see Die Hard on Friday.
Friday, yes, 4K, of course. Release 4K, coming as well.
Is that actually coming out as a 4K disc? That's the thing, though.
I think it was, unless I'm just getting it confused with Superman. Superman the movie.
The Superman movie is definitely out in 4K. That's already out. Well, I didn't know if they were re-releasing Die Hard as well in 4K.
Yeah, we should have a look.
Because it's tempting just to get it on the 4K disc and watch it at home, because, you know, instead of in the cinema.
Is it? There's a big question online, Al. Is Die Hard a Christmas movie?
Well, I think it is, because you've got snow. There are Christmas trees. He's at a Christmas party at the building where, you know, with the big heist with Alan Rickman's character, you know, he gets involved with it. He's going there for his wife's Christmas party, isn't it, at the beginning of the film, basically. So I think there is hints of Christmas. It's not a full... Once you get into the big action bit with him and Alan Rickman, being one of the best English villains you'll get in a film ever. Has it in the background, I think Christmas is a part of it. Why, if people said it isn't, then?
Well, it's down here for Cineworld, Al. Re-release, we don't have one of those in Swansea. We have a view.
If I wanted to see it, it's at the Pitch House next door on Friday at 3, I think.
So it certainly is being re-released, Al.
It's being released, I thought so. There is a 4K coming. I'm looking forward also, when I didn't get round to it yesterday, getting the 4K first Disney film in 4K, which is The Lion King. They've just re-brought out in 4K. I want to see how good that looks in that sort of quality.
And we start to see the first trailers for the new Watership Down, which is being shown on the 21st and the 22nd, I think. I thought it might have been Christmas Day.
I didn't actually know the date for that yet, so that isn't... I thought it would have started on Christmas Day. The trailer doesn't look that cute. Well, I've seen the trailer for it. It doesn't look that cute, but there are more cute elements than the manic film we've both seen.
Are children too protected today to see the original one? You know, we were... Some of us were quite traumatised by parts of it, but I think we've grown up to be okay.
Yeah, I saw it when I was doing my GCSE English. But many years ago, so when I was a teenager, and I thought it was scary. Yeah, and so I think the way it works is you can get away with it because it's like these are what rabbits do. Basically, this is the argument my teacher went with. These are what normal rabbits would do. Basically, you know, they are brutal and not fluffy and cuddly, and you don't need a female sexy rabbit. I think they've gone with Olivia Colman sort of character. But I'm hoping it balances it with the two. I think, you know, you're not going to get a scarier bunny rabbit than John Hurt.
And so Al. Doctor Who, season finale. It's come up very quickly this Sunday.
It has snuck up on us, you know. This sort of mood, this, you know, this is what happens, unfortunately. It goes fast. And I don't know, because I know nothing really about, you know, I've read the synopsis, and that doesn't really tell you a great deal. And it's either going to be some mammoth big thing, what does involve the villains or haven't been mentioned, or I think it's going to connect... What I feel is going to connect with episode one, where we met, you know, the villain there. I think it's going to connect with that, I think.
Yes, maybe old Tim Show will be back. Another fine guest star this weekend, Mark Addy from The Full Monty and latterly Game of Thrones.
Oh yeah, he will be good. He's a very good actor, he is. And I think, because I've saw the trailer bit at the end, and that didn't really give you much either. So I think they are being a little bit, we don't want you to know anything until you watch it, sort of episode. And is this one the normal length still? It's not a 60-minute then?
As far as I know, I think it's 50 minutes.
It's a 50 minutes to go, because, you know, normally we used to get, you know, the last two would be longer, wouldn't they? Well, I think, I don't know if I'm one of these people who likes, you know, sort of maybe the cliffhanger or the double, you know, episode wraps it all up, but I think I have enjoyed it all being separate episodes, because you go in like expecting something new each week. There's no sort of continuation, but I don't know, I quite like my sort of end episodes to have something big going on, you know. That's why I know people don't like some of the standalone David Tennant episodes in his last thing. Well, I really like the last two of those.
I mean, you know, stuff like World Enough and Time worked, didn't it, with, you know, the reveal of the trailer the episode before, wasn't it, with the Mondasian Cybermen?
Oh yeah, that was really good as well. You know, well, we had, you know, there was a reason for it, and it was sort of nice. You know, I like my last two episodes to be building up to something big, and it just feels this year it's a standalone episode again. It probably will be very good, but it just feels more like, again, its own entity and not any connection or giving you any peril so far. Next time on The Target Files, we will be discussing the Battle of Ranskor Avcolas, written by Chris Chibnall and directed by Jamie Childs. You can, of course, get hold of us on Facebook and found Twitter at DW Target Files. And please, of course, remember to like and review us on iTunes or on any of the other formats we're on. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Goodbye.